Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us this week. It is episode 13 of our Disney bracket. This week, we'll be discussing The Lion King, as well as Oliver and Company. Fun fact, Cheech Marin is in both of these films.
Wait, is he?
Yes, he voices Banzai the Hyena in Lion King, as well as Tito the Chihuahua in Oliver and Company.
Wow. I mean, they are basically the same character, more or less.
You're not wrong.
One is more murdery, but...
I'm not sure which of that character that is, though.
That's fair. Chichawa, Chichmarinawa, the one from Oliver and Company probably would murder somebody if he wasn't, you know, like a squish dog.
So, Lion King. All the animals in the kingdom have come to Pride Rock to celebrate the birth of King Mufasa's son, Simba, where the newborn is presented for the first time. Later, Mufasa brings Simba along on his morning duties, explaining the borders of the kingdom and their place within the circle of life. Scar, Mufasa's brother, then manipulates Simba into crossing into hyena territory, hoping to get him killed to clear a path to the throne. His plan fails when Mufasa rescues Simba and Nala from the hyena attack. Undeterred, Scar sets another plan in motion, leading Simba to a gorge and having the hyenas instigate a stampede. Scar alerts Mufasa to the danger that Simba is in, and they race to the gorge. While Mufasa is able to rescue Simba, Scar betrays his brother as he asks for help climbing up the cliff, and the king falls to his death. Scar then gaslights Simba into believing that it's Simba's fault the king is dead, and encourages him to run away and not return, sending the hyenas after him to kill him. Scar then takes the throne and allows the hyenas to occupy the Pride Lands. Meanwhile, a nearly dead Simba is found by Timon and Pumbaa, who take him under their wing and teach him their carefree lifestyle and encourage him to abandon his past. A few years later, a now adult Nala runs into the trio, and after a happy reunion, encourages Simba to return and claim the throne. He initially resists, but after an encounter with Rafiki and the spirit of Mufasa, Simba is ready to accept his responsibility and returns home, followed by Nala, Timon, and Pumbaa. While Timon and Pumbaa distract the hyenas, Simba confronts Scar in front of the Pride. Scar then taunts Simba about the death of Mufasa, backing him over the edge of a cliff, where Scar admits to the murder. Simba then pounces and forces Scar to confess to the whole Pride. Simba attempts to banish Scar, but he fights back. Simba eventually overpowers Scar and sends him over the cliff, where the hyenas he attempted to betray are waiting and take their revenge. Simba then takes his place as king, restoring balance and ending the drought that had plagued the Pride Lands. A few months later, the Animal Kingdom gathers to celebrate the birth of Simba and Nala's newborn cub.
Meanwhile, in Oliver and Company, based on Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens, a kitten, Oliver, is starving on the streets of New York when a dog, Dodger, uses him to steal some sausages. When he refuses to share, Oliver follows him home. He lives in a shack with some other dogs and Fagin, a useless man who owes a mobster, Sykes, a lot of money. Sykes has given him a 3-day deadline to pay up or it's curtains. They adopt Oliver and teach him the ways of street thievery. While boosting a cab, Oliver gets separated and adopted by Jenny, a little rich girl. She gives him food, a collar, and a good home. The other dogs, thinking Oliver needs rescuing, do so. Fagin tries to ransom him, but has a change of heart after Jenny shows up in tears with only her little piggy bank. But when Sykes kidnaps Jenny to ransom her, the dogs and Fagin team up and save her. Sykes dies in the process. Oliver goes home with Jenny for good, and everyone else rides off into New York to continue starving, die a street rat. Only their fleas will mourn them.
These are ostensibly two talking animal movies.
Talking cat movies, even.
Yes. Going into this week, we're a little concerned this was going to be pretty one-sided, but Oliver and Company is probably better than I remember it.
Yeah. I think it's still fairly one-sided, but it's not like... pitifully one-sided.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into Lion King first.
I'd like to do something different.
Oh.
Instead of talking about all the good things first with Lion King, I'd like to, like, point out all the bad things and then get to the good stuff.
I'm okay with that.
So, a few weird nitpicks that I have with the film. There's some weirdness that all these animals have this predator that is ostensibly going to eat them as their king. I think that's a little weird. While it may be kind of ecologically, biologically sound because they are the apex predator and thus they cull the weak and make sure that there's not overpopulation and there's enough food for the rest of the herbivores. I don't know, it's still kind of weird.
That comes up pretty often in the discourse and I have two counters for it. I think you're not wrong, but I will point out that most people celebrate, like, various celebrities, despite them being essentially the same thing, predators that would feed on them if they got the chance. Lion King is basically a fairly earnest representation of any, like, I want to say fascist monarchy, but, like, any... This is basically how capitalism works. It's just a little bit more obvious about it. There's also a bit where Timon is saying,
"You know her, she knows you, but she wants to eat him. And everybody's okay with this?
Did I miss something?"
And then they just all move on. So I think at some point somebody in the production was aware that this is weird, but is either too late to fix it or they didn't want to like dig into it too deeply. So they acknowledged it and then moved on. Which, again, like we all do with capitalism. A thing that's mostly an animation nitpick, there are characters can kind of change size a little bit based on the blocking of the scene. It's not a big problem, but like there's a bit where Timon is only about knee height on Simba to show his irrelevance to the conversation, whereas later he's about shoulder height. At the end, both of the fights at the end are a little lackluster. They're not awful, but like we've seen some better ones.
Yeah, especially because for the fight at the end, they go to this slow motion for part of it. Sometimes it works, like you have the slow motion of Scar leaping through the flames, or the paws batting each other in the faces. I think those parts work, but when we see them kind of panned out more and they're kind of on their haunches going at each other, there's no weight behind any of the blows, so the slow-mo feels unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. And then before that, when it's hyenas versus lionesses, it's a little chaotic and it's a little hard to tell what's happening, and it seemed more like blurs of animals as opposed to strikes that had weight. Then again, in that scene, we had Rafiki going like full Sun Wukong, so, you know, some good there.
Oh yeah, and there's that little Bruce Lee homage at the end. Oh, I love it. Another thing about the climax of the film, so the smoke and the ash and the cinders are all animated beautifully. The flames, not so much.
Yeah.
They're just kind of lackluster. We've seen better flames in Hunchback of Notre Dame and a few other places.
Mm-hmm. Tarzan has some good flames.
Yeah. Again, during the climax, there's the scene where Timon runs into Scar's quarters where Zazu is caged, and Zazu's like,
"Let me out! Let me out!
Timon,
let me in, let me in!"
And the hyenas are about to break open the cage and eat both of them. And then Pumbaa comes in, and one of the hyenas says,
"Hey, who's the pig?"
And Pumbaa gets incredibly offended. And so I know that this is a reference for the adults at the time watching the film. It's a callback to another film. I can't remember the name of it at the moment. But the fact that he gets so incensed when earlier in the film,
"Pumbaa, you are a pig."
Oh.
It just kind of rings hollow, and it felt really shoehorned in.
Mm-hmm. That scene goes on a little long, and kind of it cuts a little of the tension that was happening around it. Speaking of Pumbaa, I personally could do without the whole farting gag thing. It's a personal thing, I don't know, for kids, but I'm also...
I'm not gonna lie, I laughed a little bit when they specifically pointed out, "Oh, we can't finish this rhyme, because the rhyme is fart."
Yeah, that... That's fair. It also gives us the thing where Timon...
"Pumbaa, not in front of the kids."
Which I appreciate.
Speaking of Timon, Timon's just an asshole.
Oh, yeah.
So, last episode I talked about how Jafar had a more balanced relationship with Iago because he didn't immediately steal Iago's good idea for himself and actually congratulate him for it. Timon does the thing that I congratulated Jafar for not doing in literally the introductory scene for Timon and Pumbaa. And I'm like, oh, that's right.
Timon and Pumbaa are functionally animal versions of Horace and Jasper from 101 Dalmatians.
There's a lot of allusions to many comedy duos like Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, that sort of thing, where you have the more intelligent one and the kind of dumb one.
Mm-hmm.
Here, it reads as pretty mean for how Timon treats Pumbaa, just because he might be a little slow on the uptake. It's just really frustrating.
Mm-hmm. I think if Timon was slightly less unlikable, that would play into some of the themes and make them stronger. I also have trouble judging Timon too harshly because he's voiced by Nathan Lane, and Nathan Lane has my whole heart. I still haven't forgiven Robin Williams for being so mean to Nathan Lane in The Birdcage. There's a bit I didn't pick up on until this watching, where they're in the elephant graveyard and the hyenas are threatening to eat Nala and Simba, and Simba's like, you can't do that. And Nala's like,
technically they can. We are on their land.
The idea that different territories have different laws, basically, it makes sense, but it's kind of, I agree, a lot for kids. There's things that are like audience bonus, and there's things that you need to be this nuanced to ride the ride. You do have that one Nala's bedroom eyes scene. If you have the y-axis is bedroom eyes and the z-axis is animals in Disney, this is the furthest point on both of those axes in any movie I've seen.
Yeah, the slope of that line is one. I think both of these movies spawn some furries, but I think there's a stronger case for Lion King.
But speaking of Nala, I love Nala. She's great. One of my top Disney princesses. She's delightful. I like how she picks up on what Simba's doing pretty fast in the opening scenes. She's very driven. She goes out of her way to try to find help because the Pride Lands are dying. She doesn't take any of Simba's shit. She's good at combat.
Yeah, she's a incredibly capable woman. There's this one scene where young Simba is trying to take credit for getting rid of Zazu for them to escape to the elephant graveyard. And Nala's like,
hey genius, it was my idea.
Simba comes back.
Yeah, but I pulled it off.
I'm glad that Nala stood up for herself there.
Yeah, she will be a very good queen.
Speaking of women leaders, it's actually really interesting. So we have the trio of hyenas. We have Shenzi, played by Whoopi Goldberg, Banzai, played by Cheech Marin, and then Ed, who is voiced by Jim Cummings. But originally, instead of Whoopi Goldberg, they were going to attempt to get Tommy Chong to voice one of the hyenas, so we'd have three male hyenas. He was unavailable, so they swapped in Whoopi Goldberg, thus allowing a woman to be the kind of de facto leader of that trio, which is actually biologically accurate, considering that hyenas are a matriarchal social animal.
Nice. You also get Sarabi, who is maybe not like as headstrong as Nala, but she's still a important presence in the film. She has a lot of lines and weight, and I like her a lot.
One of my favorite scenes with Sarabi is the first morning where we're actually getting like dialogue from characters. And Simba's, like, trying to get Mufasa up.
Dad! Dad! Come on, Dad! We gotta go! Wake up!
And she's like,
your son, Dad, awake. Dad.
And Mufasa is sleepy. He's like,
before sunrise, he's your son.
Which, just a great line in general, but also technically accurate because he controls everything that the sun touches.
Yeah. That's just kind of how parents talk, and like they let these lions be parents as well as being lions.
Yeah, Mufasa might be a little quick to anger sometimes, but all the scenes that he has with Simba, he's a great dad.
An interesting thing I noticed about Mufasa is that every scene he's in, basically, like every sequence, death is brought up and discussed as a factor of life and a philosophical concept. So his death is foreshadowed, as it were. Because you have him talking about the circle of life returning to the grass and all that jazz, and also the bit of him talking about the kings above us.
There's also this great scene after the elephant graveyard where Mufasa is going to chastise Simba, sends Nala away, and Simba's walking up to his dad, and he steps and puts his foot in the paw print left by his dad, and it's just a great visual shorthand for you have some big shoes to fill. We should talk about Scar.
Yes. Oh, Scar. So, Sarah Gailey had a tweet where she said that Scar was Jafar's persona, and it made me laugh really hard. So, yeah. Shout out to Sarah Gailey. Read her hippo books.
But Scar is played so well here by Jeremy Irons. He is a master manipulator. He gaslights Simba on a number of occasions. There's a scene towards the climax of the film where he smacks Sarabi around and then immediately cowers when he thinks Mufasa has shown up. And I think that's a great insight into his character, where he loves having the power and being able to wield it however he wants to. But as soon as there is a problem that will actually challenge him physically, he shirks and tries to weasel his way out of being the one in charge. He immediately tries to blame the hyenas.
Yeah. And even in his opening scene, he says,
well, as far as brains go, I got the lion's share, but when it comes to brute strength, I'm afraid I'm at the shallow end of the gene pool.
amazing line. Mm-hmm. And I not only agree with you about him cowering from physical conflict, but I believe him about having the brain. Like, his gaslighting of Simba is masterful, and the way he talks, Jeremy Irons gives him a very, like, eloquent diction. He reads as smarter because he has that kind of, like, British aristocrat thing.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy Irons just came off of doing, I think, Shakespearean theater right before this, and they specifically wrote Scar to kind of play into that more, because he had originally declined the role, but they eventually ended up with him and sort of rewrote Scar to play more towards his strengths.
That was a good choice.
There's also the fact that Scar is providing and hunting for the hyenas, which in lion social structures is typically a role for female lions, which is a little, I don't want to say weird, but it's kind of interesting. It definitely pushes Scar more towards that foppish sort of effeminate character.
Yeah, Scar is one of the people who gets brought up as being, like, queer-coded for Disney villains, and him kind of crossing these social dynamics and gender roles and that kind of thing. I care less about the whole queer-coding of Disney villains thing, because there's so much discourse about it that I've grown weary, but the fact he's willing to go to so many lengths and to plan things out so far makes him a respectable villain. You can tell that he's a real threat. Another thing I like is that Simba and Scar have a relationship. A lot of Disney villains are disconnected from the heroes in some way. They either don't meet until halfway through, or they're just distant or whatever. Whereas here, Scar specifically and discreetly, repeatedly plans Simba's murder and tries to get Simba to be culpable and participant in it, and understands Simba well enough to gaslight and manipulate him. Simba trusts Scar for most of this movie, and so that betrayal makes it an even more impactful scene when Simba finally finds out that it wasn't him who killed Mufasa.
Let's go ahead and discuss the voice cast a little bit. It's a pretty big one, partially because both Nala and Simba have 4 different voice actors. They have a spoken and singing voice actor as cubs, as well as a spoken and singing voice actor as adults. There's an awful lot of white people in this cast for a narrative that's ostensibly about Africa. To be fair, there are quite a few black voices in this cast, a higher percentage than would be normal at the time. You have young Simba's singing voice, you have James Earl Jones as Mufasa, you have, I believe, both of the voices for young Nala, you have Robert Guillaume as Rafiki, who unfortunately passed away last year.
Mm.
Then you have Madge Sinclair as Sarabi, and Whoopi Goldberg as Shenzi. I think that about covers the people of color in the cast.
Yeah.
Well, Cheech Marin.
Oh, yeah. Which, they are animals, so it's not technically whitewashing per se, but it's still, like, I'm glad that the live-action adaption is less of that.
So you have a few black actors in the cast, and then almost everyone else is from Broadway, or has some sort of theater experience. The leap from the animated film to Broadway musical was not that large. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that it did gangbusters.
Mm-hmm. And continues to do gangbusters to this day.
Yes. So there's the part of the film where Timon and Pumbaa have to distract the hyenas.
Mm-hmm.
And Timon's like,
"What do you want me to do, dress and drag and do the hula?"
And that's exactly what happens. I have no problem with a character that Nathan Lane is portraying doing drag. That's not my issue here. It's mostly the hula issue. Hula tends to be pretty sacred to
Pacifica people?
People from indigenous to the Pacific Islands, Hawaii, Polynesia. That literally could have been any other song and dance number. That probably hasn't aged the best, especially considering how much more seriously hula has been portrayed in films like Lilo and Stitch and Moana. That's a ding against the movie.
And while it is a one-off gag, it still could have just not been there at all in the design.
Yeah. Also, again, it's another reference to Pumbaa being a pig prior to him getting upset about being called a pig.
It would have been great to have Nathan Lane do just any, like, Broadway song there.
Additionally, the issue of the hyenas sort of being coded as immigrants.
Especially since 2 of them are played by people of color?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is then muddied by Scar's villain song, Be Prepared, where he alludes to,
"And you'll never go hungry again!"
Which I kind of read as a parallel to the famine and food shortages during the Great Depression that then led to the rise of Nazism in Germany, because Never Go Hungry Again is pretty much immediately followed by goose-stepping hyenas.
The hyenas are kind of an amalgam of outsider tropes, and that outsider is anybody who doesn't live, like, in Manhattan. And it's hard to make specific assessments of, like, their role in the film and how they work as an allegory or have applicability because of that. And that messiness muddles the messages and themes of the film.
I hesitate to say definitively one way or another, like, this is how they are supposed to be read, because they're just kind of all over the place, but there are some issues there.
I want to talk about some, like, thematic stuff that I noticed that I thought was really fun.
Okay.
This is specifically that one shot at the end of Just Can't Wait to Be King, where you have all these animals rising up into a big triangle. On the one hand, you have this cool thing where it models historical manuscripts displaying the hierarchy of being, where you have animals and then humans and then angels and then God above that, arranged as a pyramid. And it's kind of cool to have similar imagery happening, but in a song that references the food chain and that kind of stuff, and has Simba literally on top of the pile. But also, earlier Mufasa talking about how nature is just in a delicate balance, and in that scene, you have all the animals balancing very gently, but then they're like, they tipped over, and then everything falls to pieces, which is exactly what happens later in the film with Scar. So it's a good way to put in a concept, reinforce the concept, and then have that concept really pay off at the end.
There's also some other interesting things with that musical number. The art style shifts completely. We actually get oranges and yellows for the backgrounds instead of these verdant greens that we'd been seeing. And all of the animals are much more abstracted and cartoon-esque.
We haven't talked much about how the songs are all 10 out of 10, but the songs are in fact all 10 out of 10.
Well, that's what happens when you have Elton John help compose them. Circle of Life is great. It's also really interesting that the first bit of dialogue that we hear is actually in Zulu.
In my notes, I have written down that it's unfair to compare any other movie's opening to Circle of Life. It sets the tone and the emotion and the themes so well.
Yeah, there's also just some great shots in that opening sequence.
The colors are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the themes of animals and divinity and that sort of stuff, we're dealing with a story about monarchy. So at least subliminally, we're dealing with having to talk about the divine right of kings.
Mm-hmm.
And you can definitely see that played up in the scene where Simba is talking to Mufasa in the clouds, and how they frame Mufasa is very similar to other depictions of dead kings and their representation of divinity. You can even look at Monty Python, does the same sort of thing.
I can't believe you have the same thought for that visual, but yeah, the clouds parting and this deity figure with the glowing halo.
It's incredibly explicit how much they're diving into, no, you have a divine right to that throne, go take it, my son.
It doesn't really unpack the
problems with...
Yeah, like, the antelopes don't get a vote here. However, I do like this, since they're dealing with monarchy, they're dealing with the idea that if you are in a position of power or are going to be, you have a responsibility to be at your best and to take care of the people you're taking care of. And that juxtaposition of responsibility versus the Hakuna Matata mentality as the backbone of Simba's character arc is a really well-explored theme.
It is.
We haven't talked much about Rafiki, but I didn't remember how much I liked him until I saw this. And I was like, oh yeah, he's fun, he's weird, he's Yoda-esque.
He has that sort of trickster mentor mentality. I do have a little bit of qualms with him because he's kind of the magical Negro trope, and he also happens to be a monkey. I'm going to go ahead and talk about Kimba a little bit here.
Oh boy.
So for those of you unfamiliar, The Lion King's narrative and a lot of the visual motifs of the film share some striking similarities with a anime adaptation of a manga. The anglicized version was called Kimba the White Lion. I believe the Japanese name roughly translates to Jungle Emperor Leo. There's some contention as to how valid the accusations of plagiarism are. Both of the higher-ups in production say that they were unfamiliar with the film until very, very late into production, but interviews with some of the people who were working closer to the ground in the animations and all that sort of stuff, no, we're animation people, of course we've seen Kimba. And there's also the fact that Matthew Broderick, initially, when he was cast for the voice work, thought he was doing it for a Western version of Kimba the White Lion.
Wow.
And the Japanese studio hasn't really pushed it because, well, we're tiny and it's Disney. There's no way we're going to win that lawsuit.
Especially since it's kind of unclear exactly who knew what.
It's just something that exists. We kind of have to figure out how you want to deal with it for yourself. I don't have any easy answers here.
Because Alex is an amazing editor, he got this down really short, but we're actually at an hour of recording about Lion King right now, so let's talk about Oliver and Company.
Whew, Oliver and Company. Technically the second Charles Dickens adaptations that we've done in this bracket.
Really? What's the first?
Christmas Carol.
Oh, right. All right.
So I think, if we're looking at the original works, I think A Christmas Carol is better than Oliver Twist.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, I'll read Oliver Twist for this episode, and then I gave up. It is a train of misery and sorrow.
There's also the fact that the message is rather muddied with how terrible it is to be poor in London during the Industrial Revolution, but also these criminals who have no other options are terrible people, and they deserve everything they get.
So this was written about 1830, and even back then, people were writing to Charles Dickens like, hey, Fagin is super anti-Semitic, fix that. And he did go back and fix things a little. Not much, but it's still not great. I'm glad they downplayed that a lot for animated Fagin.
They did cast Dom DeLuise for the voice role of Fagin, a Jewish person.
That's cool.
I also love Dom DeLuise. He's a great voice actor. It is a sad loss.
Dom DeLuise is great. However, I kind of hate Fagin. I'm sorry.
Oh no, Fagin as a character is not that great. So, we talked about the source material. They follow it very loosely here. There's not a whole lot of similarities beyond character names and the fact that the main character is an orphan.
This is just a rags-to-riches type story, and I think it's better for being streamlined. The characters are not the strong elements of this movie, I don't think. Dodger has some fun to him, and I do love Georgette, even though she is the fourth best Bette Midler in a Disney film. So, while we're on Georgette, she has a song, which is fine. It's not great, but it's Bette Midler, so it's serviceable, where she talks about being a show dog and a breeding dog while flopping down onto a pillow, and behind her are arrayed about 2 dozen pictures of other dogs, as if they were her old lovers or admirers. And the sexual nature of that character is a lot for this film, which is up to now pretty tame.
There's also this scene when the gang initially breaks into her home.
Oh god, this line.
Where she assumes that Dodger is there to sexually assault her and is terrified and all that, and then...
You're barking up the wrong tree. It's not you I'm after.
And then she's like,
well, why not? What's the problem, Spot? Not good enough for you? I mean, do you even know who I am?
Wow, way to mix messages, Disney.
And then Tito also spends most of the movie pursuing her, and she's like clearly not interested, but then they wind up together at the end. And it's...
I guess there's like some acts of heroism rescuing Jenny that kind of turn her around, but there's also the fact that they get together, and then Tito realizes, oh, she wants to change me, and then runs away.
It's messy.
So this came out in 1988, and it is stark how much that they were able to get away with in a kid's films back then. There's a gun in this movie.
There's a gun in this
movie.
There's
multiple characters smoking. The main villain, Sykes, talks about putting a guy in cement shoes.
One of my favorite lines of this movie is he's just sitting on the phone while Fagin is walking into his office like,
what do you mean? You start with the knuckles.
It's just like, it's so casual. I'm like, yes, good, wonderful. Perfect characterization.
Yeah, so there's some dark undercurrents of this movie.
And weirdly, it's much lighter than in the novel, where Sykes is dating the Rita equivalent.
Also, there's this problem with Sykes, where whenever I see him, I can only think of Rudy Giuliani.
Oh no.
Honestly, part of that makes the film better, because I'm like, yes, I can totally see Rudy Giuliani doing all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to mention the really shitty bad breed stuff with Roscoe and DeSoto, the Dobermans for Sykes, is not the best, but definitely from its time. There's also this one-off line where Rita is like,
run along, Roscoe. Your master's calling.
And both Rita and Roscoe's voice actors are black. Is that supposed to be like a Uncle Tom slavery sort of thing?
I'm not sure if the movie knows, and I think the less thought about that, the better. Oh, speaking of the breeds, can you talk about how Dodger's gang is just the dogs from the pound from Lady and the Tramp?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, we also do see some other dogs from Lady and the Tramp and 101 Dalmatians in here during Why Should I Worry? A lot of these dog-centric movies, they try and slip those characters in, at least the background. You do mention they are kind of just rehashes of people in the pound. However, Tito is a little bit more feisty and less lazy. They kind of let Cheech Marin just ad-lib about 30% of his lines. I think it works okay. He's obviously just Cheech Marin here.
I wasn't a fan of the character, but it's to each their own.
There's also the fact that Francis is definitely played against type, whereas the English bulldog you had in Lady and the Tramp was sort of this kind of dumb cockney bruiser sort of character. Francis is like this posh Brit who's very into Shakespearean theater.
He's functionally Alan Rickman's character from Galaxy Quest, in that he really thinks he's a great actor, and whether or not he is technically a great actor is debatable at this point. He's my favorite character in this movie, actually.
I do really like Francis. It's really interesting because his voice actor is actually black.
Yeah, that's nice.
Which is neat. Casting a black person for a Brit character doesn't happen all that often in American media.
Although, speaking of which, there are a lot of white people in New York in this movie.
We do see a few minorities.
Yeah, a few.
There's the little Asian boy who almost picks up Oliver, and then there is the black man with the boombox.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's about it.
That's about it, yeah. I guess arguably Fagin, but not explicit.
Like, while I do love Francis, he also gets two really mean fat jokes thrown at him.
Yeah.
Which, not the best.
No.
Another moment that I had watching this film, I actually had to pause and just, like, stop for about 30 seconds, is... So there's a lot of skyline shots of New York. They really tried to show off the city for this movie. And there's specifically one shot about halfway-ish through the film where they just pause on the two towers and it shifts from night to day. And I'm just like, oh, wow, those are still there.
Yep. There's a lot of New York stuff in this movie. I appreciate that. I appreciate that it did feel like New York.
One of the reasons that the cast in this is pretty diverse is they just filled it up with New York people. It makes sense. I think it actually really works. The voice cast here is probably one of the best things about the film.
A weird thing that I liked about this film, it has a lot of scenes where like electrocution is happening or there's like electricity flying around and it looks really good. It's very beautiful electricity for some reason.
Yeah, they do a really good job with the electricity. But also, Tito gets shocked a couple times in the film, but he's fine. But as far as we know, Roscoe, the Doberman that falls off of Sykes' car during that chase scene on the tracks, is electrocuted and is dead. And that's dark.
Yeah, they shock a dog to death. So that's a lot. On the flip side, there is a scene where someone is fooled with a pizza box being delivered by literally two dogs in a trench coat.
I think it's three dogs, but yes.
Yes. So that made me happy.
There's also the fact that we never figure out why Fagin borrowed the money, for what reason. He's living in poverty. I don't understand what happened to this amount of money that he borrowed.
So this is one of the reasons this film has many problems, is that it's very short. It's an hour 15 minutes. Like, it is approximately as long as those animated Justice League movies. They pop out five of a year. And we need a few more scenes for some of these characters. Like, if, like, Fagin's reason for needing that money was he wanted to, like, give it all to a... for a kid's eye operation or some shit, and, you know, he's actually a really noble guy who just keeps getting down on his luck, that would work really well for me as a character trait. That would make me like him a lot, actually.
Yeah, or if he had opened up a animal shelter, and that's why he has all these animals, and he's taking care of them, but, you know, the loan truck's coming to collect, so now he has to use these strays to help pickpocket.
Yeah, well, can we talk about how man uses dogs as street thieves and pickpockets on New York is somehow not a thrilling plot? That should be great. That should be an amazing film.
This film could have been a lot better, but it's short, and there's so many characters. Over half of this film is spent setting up characters and the main conflict. It's ridiculous. They do not utilize their time very well. Part of that is due to these very long, extended musical numbers, only one of which I think is even remotely worth it.
Why Should I Worry is a wonderful song.
Yeah, it's Billy Joel. He's like on the top of his game. It's a really great song. It's the best song in the movie. Nothing else compares. Georgette's is okay, and then the rest are pretty
forgettable. I had a like notes for each song, and one of them just reads, "I made a sandwich." So I'm going to do a good thing and a bad thing. They're both art related. A good thing is a lot of the backgrounds have this like graffiti aesthetic. Like they have kind of these very like these layers of colors that kind of feel like you would see on an alleyway wall. I like that. It feels New York-y. On the flip side, a lot of the human animations, especially during the crowd scenes, are like something from a ripoff of He-Man. This wasn't like a great time for them.
This was right before they got really big again with The Little Mermaid. So they were in one of the worst spots they'd been in since prior to Cinderella.
Oh, we haven't actually talked about Oliver, the character, that much.
That's because he's barely a character. He's almost just a plot device.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, he does have some moments. Like, he does, like, scratch a dog twice. But he often doesn't have an active role in things. And he wants to be a house cat. And he doesn't seem like he would really do much with his life if he weren't thrown into these situations. I mean, that is pretty faithful to the novel. Oliver is also kind of a nothing character there.
In Oliver Twist, it makes sense for him to be a passive character because he's young and he's being manipulated and used by all these adults to various nefarious ends. And he's kind of meant to just be a point of view character for this is how bad it is on the London streets and we need to help the poor and fix income inequality. But this film wants to try and make a point about income inequality, but it doesn't at all. I can definitely see bones for it trying to do that, but doesn't. Oh, hey, this homeless man and his four dogs helped save this kidnapped girl, so we're gonna invite them to her birthday party, and then they're just gonna ride off into the sunset without us rewarding them for their help or anything like that.
Giving them a job or like a house somewhere.
Yeah, it's not like they can't afford it. Jenny's parents are vacationing in France, and they have a butler, and they live on Fifth Avenue. They have some income. There's a reason that Sykes was ransoming the child.
Again, it's so short that they don't really have time to like get into things. And because of that, because Fagin doesn't like be like, hey, I saved this child's life and all of your money. Could I have like a job somewhere or something? It kind of makes it seem like he's happy being poor, which is maybe not an intentional thing, but it's a little bit weird. The movie wants us to buy that Oliver matters a lot to some of these characters, to Jenny, the human who adopts him, to Dodger and the other dogs, but they only know each other for a day or two at most, and I don't buy that relationship being worth risking life and limb so much. I mean, I guess noble for noble's sake, but I don't buy them being like, oh no, he's one of us, person we met yesterday.
This movie just falls flat in lots of places.
Yeah.
I think it's time to render our final decision.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Lion King. I mean,
amongst our local friends, we've definitely talked about this being the most one-sided matchup in our bracket. And we weren't wrong. It's definitely Lion King moving forward. Lion King is one of Disney's best films ever. It's gone on to win many awards. It's had a couple sequels, a couple television shows, and gone on to be adapted to a Broadway musical. And they're also making a remake with a nearly all-black cast.
And while the movie definitely has problems, probably even maybe deeper meta problems than Oliver and Company does, its qualities kind of push it above Oliver and Company as well.
Oh yeah. Like, the characters have much more depth, the animation is much prettier, and it looks like they had a decent budget.
Mm-hmm. And it has about as many characters, but it balances them all pretty well.
And also, the music is much more memorable here than most of the songs in Oliver and Company. So, that's our decision this week.
What's up next week?
Next up will be Zootopia versus The Little Mermaid.
Thanks for joining us this week. We hope you join us next week. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook.
I'm assuming you're also listening to this on Podbean. You can find us there.
Mm-hmm. We hope you'll be part of our world next week.
Thank you, and have a magical day.